heart of British government. Just after midday, I read the last email, put my coat on, walked down the road and waited for the 52 bus. I got off at Brondesbury Park, walked the length of Christchurch Avenue, arrived at Tracy's estate, climbed the stairs and rang her bell. She must have been in the hallway already because she opened the door right away, a new baby of 4 or 5 months on her hip, its face turned from me. Behind her I could hear more children arguing and a TV at high volume. I don't know what I expected, but what was in front of me was an anxious, heavy-set, middle-aged woman in terry-cloth pyjama bottoms, house slippers, and a black sweatshirt that had one word written on it, Obey. I looked so much younger. It's you, she said. She put a protective hand to the back of her baby's head. Tracy, we need to talk.
Mum!
Cried a voice from inside.
Who is it?
Yeah, well, I'm in the middle of making lunch. My mother is dying, I said. That old childhood habit of exaggeration spontaneously came back to me. And you've got to stop what you're... Just then, her two older children stuck their heads round the door to stare at me. The girl looked white, with wavy brown hair and sea-green eyes. The boy had Tracy's colouring and a springy afro, but didn't look especially like her. He must have taken after his father. The baby was far darker than all of us, and when she turned her face towards me, I saw she was Tracy's double and incredibly beautiful. But they all were. Can I come in? She didn't answer. She sighed, pushed the door open with her slippered foot, and I followed her in.
Who are you? Who are you? Who are you?
The little girl asked me, and before she got an answer, slipped her hand into mine. I saw, as we walked through the lounge, that I had interrupted a screening of South Pacific. This detail moved me, and made it hard to keep in mind the hateful Tracy of the emails, or the Tracy who had put that letter through my door 10 years before. I knew the Tracy who wasted an afternoon on South Pacific, and I loved that girl.
You like it?
Her daughter asked me. And when I said I did, she pulled my arm till I sat on the settee between her and her older brother, who was playing on a phone. I had marched down Brondesbury Park full of righteous fury, but now it seemed completely possible that I might just sit on this sofa and pass the afternoon watching South Pacific with the little girl's hand nestled in mine. I asked for her name.
Mariah, Mimi, Alicia, Chantel.
Her name's Jenny, said the boy without looking up. I thought he looked to be 8, and Jenny 5 or 6.
And what's your name?
I asked, cringing to hear my mother's voice in me, talking to all children, whatever their age, as if they were barely sentient.
My name's Beau,
he said, imitating my intonation, making himself laugh. The laugh was pure Tracy.
And what is your story, Miss Woman? Are you from the Department of Social Care?
No, I'm a... friend of your mum's. We grew up together.
Maybe,
he said, as if the past were a hypothetical he could take or leave. He reapplied himself to the game he was playing.
Never seen you before, though, so I got my suspicions. This bit is happy talk, said Jenny, delighted, pointing at the screen, and I said,
yes, but I have to talk to your mummy. Although everything in me wanted to stay on the sofa, holding her hot little hand, feeling Beau's knee resting inadvertently against mine.
Okay, but come back straight after you do your talking.
She was clattering around the kitchen with her baby daughter on her hip, and didn't pause when I entered. Great kids, I found myself saying, as she piled plates and gathered cutlery. Sweet and sharp. She opened the oven, it almost scraped the opposite wall.
What are you making?
She forced the door shut again, and with her back to me, shifted her baby to the opposite side. Everything was the wrong way round. I was a solicitous, apologetic one, she in a place of righteousness. The flat itself seemed to draw this submissive role out of me. On the stage of Tracy's life, I had no other role to play. I really need to talk to you, I said again. She turned round. She had a proper face on, as we used to say, but when we caught each other's eyes, we smiled. It was involuntary, a mutual smirk.
"I'm not even laughing, though," she said, reassuming her face. "And if you've come in here just to start one with me, you'd best just leave again, because I'm not up for it."
"I came here to ask you to stop harassing my mother."
"Is that what she told you?"
"Tracy, I read your emails." She put the baby over her shoulder and started jiggling it and patting its back over and over.
"Listen, I live in this area," she said. "Unlike you. I see what goes on. They can talk it up in Parliament all they like, but I'm on the ground in here, and your mother's meant to be repping these streets. She's on TV every other night, but you see anything different round here? My boy has got 130 IQ, all right? He's been tested. He's ADHD. His brain goes so fast and he's bored every day in that shithole. Yeah, he gets into trouble because he's bored. And all his teachers can think to do with him is expel him.
Tracy, I don't know anything about that, but you can't just...
Oh, stop stressing. Make yourself useful. Help me get these plates in."
She handed me them, put the cutlery on top, and directed me back to the living room, where I found myself setting the small, round table for her family, just as I had once set tea time for her dolls.
"Luncheon is served," she said, in what seemed to be an imitation of my voice.
Playfully, she slapped both the older children round the back of their heads.
"If it's lasagna again, I'm going to start crying on my knees," said Beau,
and Tracy said, "It's lasagna." And Beau assumed the position and comically beat the floor with his fists.
"Get up, you joker," said Tracy,
and they were all laughing, and I did not know how to continue in my mission. At the table, I sat quietly while they argued and laughed over every little thing, everybody seeming to talk as loudly as possible, swearing freely, and the baby still on Tracy's knee being bounced up and down while Tracy fed herself, one-handed, and bantered with the other two. And perhaps this was how their lunchtimes always were. But I couldn't rid myself of the suspicion that it was also, on Tracy's part, a form of performance, a way of saying, "Look at the fullness of my life. Look at the emptiness of yours."
"Are you still dancing?"
I asked suddenly, interrupting them all. "I mean, professionally." The table went quiet, and Tracy turned to me.
"Do I look like I'm still dancing?"
She looked down at herself and around the table and laughed harshly.
"I know I was the smart one, but get a fucking clue."
I never told you, Trace, but I saw you in Showboat."
She did not look remotely surprised. I wondered whether she had spotted me at the time.
"Yeah, well, that's all ancient history. Mum got ill, there was no one to look after the kids. It got too hard. I've had some health issues myself. Wasn't for me."
"What about their dad?
What about their dad what?
Why can't he look after them?" I was pointedly using the singular, but Tracy, always alert to euphemism or hypocrisy, was not fooled by it.
"Well, as you can see, I tried vanilla, cafe au lait, and chocolate. And you know what I figured out? On the inside, they're all the fucking same. Men."
I was rattled by her language, but the kids, their chairs turned towards South Pacific, did not seem to notice or care.
"Maybe the problem is the kind of men you choose."
Tracy rolled her eyes.
"Thank you, Dr. Freud. Hadn't thought of that. Any other pearls of wisdom for me?"
I kept quiet and ate my lasagna, still partially frozen in the middle, but delicious. It reminded me of her mother, and I asked how she was.
"She died a couple of months ago." "Didn't she, Princess? She died. Nana died. She went to the angels." "Yeah, just us now. We're okay, though. These fucking social workers keep bothering us, but we're all right. Four musketeers. We burned Nana in a big fire."
Beau turned round. "You're such an idiot. We didn't just burn her, did we? Like, we just put her on a bonfire or something. She was cremated. Better than getting stuck in the ground in some closed-up box. No, thank you. That's how I want mine, too. Nana was like me, because she hated closed-up spaces. She was claustrophobic. That's why she always took the stairs."
Tracy smiled fondly at Beau and reached out for him,
which she ducked and avoided.
She got to see the kids, though, she murmured, almost to herself. Even little Bella. So I feel good about that.
She brought Bella up to her lips and kissed her all over her nose, then looked over to me and gestured towards my womb.
What are you waiting for?
I stuck my nose in the air, realizing too late that it was a borrowed gesture, one I'd been using for years in moments of pride or adamancy, and that it properly belonged to the woman sitting opposite me.
The right situation, I said. The right time.
She smiled, the old cruelty in her face.
Oh, okay. Good luck with that. Funny, innit?
She said, exaggerating her accent for effect and turning to the television, not me.
Rich birds with no kids, poor birds with plenty. Sure your mum would have a lot to say about that.
The kids finished eating. I picked up their plates and took them to the kitchen and sat there for a minute on the high stool, breathing in and out mindfully, as Amy's yoga teacher had shown us all how to do, and looking out through the strip of window into the parking bays. There were answers I wanted from her, going a long way back. I was trying to work out how to re-enter the living room in a way that would reset the afternoon in my favour, but before I figured it out, Tracy walked in and said,
"Thing is, what's between me and your mum is between me and your mum. I don't even know why you've come round here, honestly.
I'm just trying to understand why you would..."
"Yeah, but that's the thing. There can't be no understanding between you and me anymore. You're part of a different system now. People like you think you can control everything, but you can't control me."
"People like me? What are you talking about? Trace, you're a grown woman now. You've got three beautiful kids. You really need to get a grip on this kind of delusional..."
"You can call it by any fancy name you like, love. There's a system, and you and your fucking mother are both a part of it."
I stood up. "Stop harassing my family, Tracy," I said, as I walked purposefully out of the kitchen, pursued by Tracy through the living room towards the front door. "If it carries on, the police will be involved."
"Yeah, yeah, keep walking, keep walking," she said, and slammed the door behind me.
6. In early December, Amy returned to check on the progress of her academy, travelling with a smaller group. Granger, Judy, her ditzy email proxy Mary Beth, Fern and me. Without press and with a specific agenda. She wanted to propose a sexual health clinic within the grounds of the school itself. Nobody disagreed in principle, but it was also very difficult to see how it could possibly be referred to publicly as a sexual health clinic, or how Fern's discreet reports of the sexual vulnerability of the local girls, which she had gathered slowly and with a great deal of trust from a few of the female teachers, who had taken great risks themselves in speaking to him, could be brought out into the light of the village without causing interpersonal chaos and offence, and perhaps the end of our whole project. On the flight over, we discussed it. I tried, stumblingly, to speak to Amy about the need for delicacy, and what I knew of the local context, thinking in my mind of Hauer, while Fern, more eloquently, discussed an earlier German medical NGO's interventions in a nearby Mandinka village, where female circumcision was practiced by all, and the German nurses had found oblique approaches, one traction, where more direct condemnations failed. Amy frowned at these comparisons, and then took up again where she had left off.
"Look, it happened to me in Bendigo, it happened to me in New York, it happens everywhere. It's not about your local context, this is everywhere. I had a big family, cousins and uncles coming and going, I know what goes on. And I'll bet you $1 million you go into any classroom of 30 girls anywhere in this world, and there's going to be one, at least, who has a secret she can't tell. I remember. I had nowhere to go. I want these girls to have somewhere to go."
Beside her own passion and commitment, our qualifications and concerns looked petty and narrow, but we managed to wear her down to the word clinic, and an emphasis, at least when discussing the clinic with local mothers, on menstrual health,
which was its own complication for many girls, without the means to pay for sanitary products. But personally, I didn't think Amy was wrong. I remembered my own classrooms, dance classes, playgrounds, youth groups, birthday parties, hen nights. I remember there was always a girl with a secret, with something furtive and broken in her. And walking through the village with Amy, entering people's homes, shaking their hands, accepting their food and drink, being hugged by their children, I often thought I saw her again, this girl who lives everywhere and at all times in history, who is sweeping the yard or pouring out tea or carrying somebody else's baby on her hip and looking over at you with a secret she can't tell. It was a difficult first day. We were glad to be back, and there was unexpected pleasure in touring a village no longer so strange or alien to us, seeing familiar faces, in Fern's case, people who had become intimate friends. And yet we were all also on edge because we knew that Amy, though she attended to her duties and smiled in the photographs Granger was tasked with taking, had a mind full of lamin. Every few minutes she glared at Mary Beth, who tried to call again but only got voicemail. In some compounds connected to lamin through blood or friendship, we asked for him, but nobody seemed to know where he was. They'd seen him yesterday or earlier in the morning. Perhaps he'd gone to Barra or Banjul, perhaps to Senegal to see his family. By late afternoon, Amy was struggling to hide her irritation. We were meant to be asking people how they felt about the changes in the village and what more they wanted to see, but Amy glazed over if people spoke to her for any length of time, and we began moving in and out of compounds with too much speed, causing offence. I wanted to linger. I wondered whether this would be our last visit, and I felt some urgency to retain everything I saw, to imprint the village in my memory, its unbroken light, the greens and yellows, those white birds with their blood-red beaks, and the people, my people. But somewhere in these streets, a young man was hiding from Amy, a humiliating feeling, a new one for her, she who had always been the person others ran towards. To avoid reflecting on this, I could see she was determined to keep moving, and as much as her purposes frustrated my own, I still felt sorry for her. I was 12 years behind her, but I, too, felt my age among all those scandalously young girls whom we met in every compound, too beautiful, confronting us both that hot afternoon, with the one thing no amount of power or money can return to you once it's gone. Just before sunset, we moved to the very east end of the village, on the border of where it stopped being the village and became the bush once more. There were no compounds here, only corrugated iron huts, and it was in one of these we met the baby. All very tired, extremely hot, we didn't notice at first that there was anyone else in the small space, other than the woman whose hand Amy was presently shaking, but as I stepped round to make space for Granger to get inside and out of the sun, I saw a baby laid out on a cloth on the floor, with another girl of about 9, at the baby's side, stroking the infant's face. We had seen many babies, of course, but none as young as this. It was 3 days old. The woman wrapped her up and passed the tiny package to Amy, who accepted it into her arms and stood there staring at it, without making any of the usual comments people feel they should make when holding a newborn. Granger and I, feeling awkward, came close and made these comments ourselves. Girl or boy, how beautiful, what smallness, such eyes, such lovely thick black tufts of hair. I was saying these things automatically, I'd said them many times before, until I looked at her. Her eyes were huge, wonderfully lashed, black and purple, unfocused. No matter how I tried to get her to look at me, she wouldn't. She was a little god refusing me grace, though I was on my knees. Amy held the baby tighter, turned from me, and placed her own nose on the child's bud lips. Granger went outside to get some air. I moved close again to Amy and craned over the baby. Time passed. The two of us, side by side, unpleasantly close, sweating on each other, but both unwilling to risk moving from the baby's sightline. The mother was speaking, but I don't think either of us really heard her. At last, Amy, very reluctantly, turned and placed the baby in my arms. It's a chemical thing, maybe,
like the dopamine that floods through people in love. For me, it was a drowning. I have never experienced anything like it before or since.
"You like her? You like her?"
said a jovial man who'd appeared from somewhere.
"Take her to London. Ha ha! You like her?"
Somehow, I passed her back to her mother. At the same time, in some place of alternative futures, I ran straight out of there with the baby in my arms, hailed a taxi to the airport, and flew home. When the sun fell and nothing more could be done in the way of visiting, we decided to end the day and convene the next morning for the school tour and a village meeting. Amy and the rest followed Fern to the pink house. I, curious about what had changed since my last visit, headed to Howard's. In the absolute darkness, I made my way very slowly towards what I thought was the main crossing, reaching out for tree trunks like a blind person, and astonished at every turn by the many adults and children I felt passing by me, who walked quickly and efficiently, without torches, to wherever it was they were going. I made it to the crossing and was steps from Howard's door when Lamond appeared beside me. I hugged him and told him Amy had been looking for him everywhere and expected to see him tomorrow. "I am just here. I have not been anywhere. Well, I'm going to see Howard. Will you come?" "You won't find her. She went 2 days ago to get married. She is back to visit tomorrow. She would like to see you." I wanted to commiserate, but there was no right phrase. "You must come to the school tour tomorrow," I repeated. "Amy looked for you all day." He kicked at a stone in the ground. "Amy is a very nice lady. She is helping me, and I am thankful, but..." He stopped at the line, like a man fluffing a long jump, but then suddenly jumped anyway. "She is an old woman. I am a young man, and a young man wants to have children." We stood outside Howard's door, looking at each other. He was so close, I felt his breath on my neck. I think I knew then that it would happen between us, that night or the next, and that it would be a commiseration offered with the body in the absence of any clearer or more articulate solution. We didn't kiss, not in that moment. He didn't even reach for my hand. There was no need. We both understood that it was already decided. "Well, come in," he said finally, opening Howard's door as if it were that to his own home. "You are here. It is late. You will eat here." Standing on the veranda looking out, in more or less exactly the same spot I had last seen him, was Howard's brother, Babu. We greeted each other very warmly. Like everyone I met, he considered the fact that I had chosen to return once again as some kind of virtue in itself, or he pretended to find it so. To Lamin he gave only a nod, whether through familiarity or frostiness I couldn't tell. But when I asked about Howard, his face definitively fell. "I was there yesterday for the marriage, the only witness. For myself, I don't care if there are singers or dresses or platters of food. None of it matters to me. But to my grandmother's. She has started a war in this place. I will have to listen to women complaining until the end of my days." "Do you think she's happy?" He smiled as if I had been caught out somehow. "Ah, yes. For Americans, this is always the most important question." Dinner was brought to us, a feast, really, and we ate outside, with the grandmothers forming a talkative circle at the other end of the veranda, looking over at us occasionally, but too busy with their own discussion to pay us much mind. We had a solar lamp at our feet that lit us from below. I could see my food and the lower parts of Lamin and Howard's brother's faces, and then beyond there were the usual busy noises of domestic work and children laughing, crying, shouting, and people walking from the various outhouses back and forth across the yard. What you didn't hear were men's voices. Now I heard some very close at hand, and Lamin stood up suddenly and pointed at the compound wall, where, either side of the doorway, half a dozen men now sat, their legs facing towards the road. Lamin took a step towards them, but Howard's brother caught him by the shoulder and sat him back down,
approaching instead himself, with two of his grandmothers at his side. I saw one of the young men was smoking, and now flicked his cigarette over into our yard. But when Howard's brother reached them, it turned out to be a quick conversation. He said something, one boy laughed, a grandmother said something, he spoke again, more firmly, and six backsides slipped out of view. The grandmother who had spoken opened the door and watched them walk on, down the road. The moon came out from a cover of clouds, and from where I stood, I could see at least one of them had a gun on his back. "They are not from here. They are from the other end of the country," said Howard's brother, rejoining me. He still wore his bloodless conference room smile, but behind his designer glasses, I could see in his eyes how shaken he was. "We see it more and more. They hear the president wants to rule for a billion years. They are running out of patience. They begin listening to other voices, foreign voices, or the voice of God. If you believe this can be bought on a Casio tape for $25 in the market. Yes, they are out of patience, and I do not blame them. Even our calm Lamin, our patient Lamin, he too has run out of patience." Lamin reached out for a slice of white bread, but did not speak. "And when do you leave?" asked Babu of Lamin, his tone so full of judgment, of blame, that I assumed he referred to the back way, but they both chuckled at the panic that must have passed over my face. No, he will have his official papers. It is all being arranged, thanks to you people who are here. We are already losing all our brightest young men, and now you take another. It is sad, but this is the way things are." "You left?" said Lamin, sullenly. He pulled a fishbone from his mouth. "That was a different time. I was not needed here. I am not needed here." Babu did not answer, and his sister was not there to fill up the spaces between us with chatter. When we had finished our quiet meal, I preempted those many child maids, gathered the plates together, and walked in the direction I'd seen those girls go, towards the last room in the block, which turned out to be a bedroom. I stood in the dim light, unsure what to do next, when one of the half a dozen sleeping children in there raised his head from their single bed, saw the load in my arms, and pointed me through a curtain. I found myself outside, in the yard again, but this was the backyard, and here were the grandmothers and some of the older girls, crouched around several tubs of water in which clothes were being washed with large bars of grey soap. A circle of solar lamps illuminated the scene. As I came upon them, work paused to observe some live animal theatre. A cockerel chasing a hen, overpowering her, putting his claw to her neck, driving her head into the dust, finally mounting her. This operation took only a minute, but throughout the hen looked bored, impatient to get on with her other tasks, so that the cockerel's brutal sense of his power over her seemed somehow comic.
"Big man! Big man!"
cried one of the grandmothers, spotting me, pointing at the cockerel. The women laughed. The hen was released. She wandered around in a circle, once, twice, three times, apparently dazed, before returning to the hen house and her sisters and her chicks. I put the plates where I was told to, on the ground, and came back to find that Lamin had already left. I understood it was a signal. I announced that I, too, was going to bed, but instead lay in my room in my clothes, waiting for the last sounds of human activity to fade. Just before midnight, I took my head torch, made my way quietly through the yard, out of the compound, and through the village. Amy had thought of this visit as a fact-finding trip, but the village committee considered everything a reason for celebration, and the next day, as we finished the school tour and entered the yard, we found a drum circle awaiting us under the mango tree, 12 late middle-aged women with drums between their thighs. Even Fern hadn't been warned, and Amy was agitated at this new delay to the schedule, but there was no way to avoid it. This was an ambush. The children streamed out and formed a second huge circle around their drumming mothers, and we, the Americans, were asked to sit in the innermost circle on little chairs taken from the classrooms. The teachers went to get these, and among them, approaching from the very other end of the school, over by Lamin's maths class, I spotted Lamin and Hauer walking together, carrying 4 little chairs each. But I did not, when I saw him, feel in any way self-conscious, nor was I ashamed. The events of the night before were so separated from my daytime life that it felt to me that they had happened to someone else. A shadow body who pursued separate aims and could not be forced into the light. I waved to them both. They showed no sign of seeing me. The drumming started. I couldn't shout over it. I turned back towards the circle and took the seat offered to me next to Amy. The women began taking turns in the circle, laying their drum aside to dance in dramatic 3-minute bursts, a kind of anti-performance, for despite the brilliance of their footwork, the genius in their hips, they did not turn outwards to their audience, but instead remained facing their drumming sisters, their backs to us. As the second woman started, Hauer entered the circle and took the seat next to me that I'd been saving for her. But Lamin only nodded at Amy before sitting himself on the other side of the circle, as far from her, and I suppose from me, as he could manage. I squeezed Howard's hand and offered my congratulations.
I am very happy. It was not easy for me to be here today, but I wanted to see you.
Is Bakari with you?
No! He thinks I'm buying fish in Barra. He does not like dancing like this,
she said, and moved her feet a little in echo of the woman stamping away a few yards from us.
But, of course, I won't dance myself, so no harm is done.
I squeezed her hand again. There was something wonderful about being near her. She cut every situation to her own dimension, believed she could adapt anything until it suited, even as flexibility fell out of fashion. At the same time, a paternalistic, or perhaps I should write here, maternalistic, impulse surged through me. I kept hold of her hand, too tightly, in the hope, the irrational hope, that it would, like some cheap charm bought of a marabou, confer protection, keep her safe from evil spirits whose existence in the world I no longer doubted. But when she turned and saw the creases in my forehead, she laughed at me and freed herself, clapping to welcome the arrival of Granger into the circle, who moved round it as if it were a breakdancer's ring, showing off his heavy-footed moves to the delight of the drumming mothers. After a suitable minute of reticence, Amy joined him. To avoid watching her, I looked around the circle at all the adamant, inflexible love, sadly misdirected. I could feel Fern to my right, staring at me. I watched Lamin look up every now and then, his glances directed only at Hauer, her perfect face wrapped up tightly like a present. But in the end, I could not evade the image of Amy, dancing for Lamin, at Lamin, to Lamin, like someone dancing for a rain that will not fall. 8 drumming women later, even Mary Beth had attempted a dance, and it was my turn. I had a mother pulling each arm, dragging me up. Amy had extemporized. Granger had historicized. Moonwalk, the robot, the running man. But I still had no ideas about dance. Only instincts. I watched them for a minute, the 2 women, as they danced at me, teasing me, and I listened carefully to the multiple beats and knew that what they were doing I, too, could do. I stood between them and matched them step for step. The kids went crazy. There were so many voices screaming at me I stopped being able to hear the drums, and the only way I could carry on was to respond to the movements of the women themselves, who never lost the beat, who heard it through everything. 5 minutes later, I was done and more tired than if I'd run 6 miles. I collapsed next to Hauer, and from some fold of her new hijab, she produced a small piece of material with which I wiped some of the sweat from my face.
Why are they saying, too bad? Was I that bad?
No! You were so great! They are saying, Tubab. This means,
she traced her hand across the skin of my cheek.
So they are saying, even though you are a white girl, you dance like you are a black. I say it's true. You and Amy, both of you, you really dance like you are blacks. It is a big compliment, I would say. I never would have guessed this about you. My, my, you even dance as well as Granger.
Amy, overhearing,
burst out laughing. 7. Some days before Christmas, I was sitting in the London house at the desk in Amy's study, finalizing the list for the New Year party, when I heard Estelle somewhere upstairs. She was saying, "Dear, dear." It was a Sunday. The second floor office was closed. The children had not yet returned from their new boarding school, and Judy and Amy were in Iceland for 2 nights doing promotion. I had not seen or heard of Estelle since the children left, and had presumed, if I even thought of her at all, that her services were no longer required. Now I heard that familiar lilt, "Dare, dare." I ran up a floor and found her in Cara's old room, in what we used to call the nursery. She stood by the sash windows, looking out onto the park, in her comfy crocs and a black sweater, embroidered with gold thread, like tinsel, and a pair of sensible pleated navy trousers. Her back was to me, but when she heard my tread, she turned round, a swaddled baby in her arms. It was so tightly wrapped, it looked unreal, like a prop. I approached quickly, reaching out.
"You can't just come up and touch the baby. Your hands got to be clean."
And it took a great deal of self-control to take a step away from them both and put my hands behind my back. "Estelle, whose baby is that?" The baby yawned. Estelle looked down at it adoringly.
"Adopted 3 weeks ago, I believe. You didn't know? Seemed to me everybody know. But she just arrived here last night. Her name is Sankofa. Don't ask me what kind of name is that, because I could not tell you. Why anybody won't give a lovely little baby like this a name like that, I must say I don't know. I am going to call her Sandra until somebody make me stop."
The same purple, dark, unfocused gaze sliding off me, fascinated by itself. I could hear in Estelle's voice the delight she already took in the child. Far more, it seemed to me, than she had ever taken in Jay and Cara, whom she had practically raised. And I tried to focus on the tale of this lucky, lucky little girl in her arms, rescued from the back of beyond, placed in the lap of luxury. Better not to wonder how it had possibly been managed, an international adoption in less than a month. I reached out again. My hands were shaking.
"If you want to hold her so bad, I'm about to wash her right now. Come upstairs with me, you can clean your hands."
We went to Amy's gigantic ensuite, which had at some point been quietly made ready for a baby. A set of towels with rabbit ears, baby powders and oils, baby sponges and baby soaps, and half a dozen multicolored plastic ducks lined up along the edge of the bath.
"All this nonsense."
Estelle crouched to examine a kooky little device made of terry cloth with a metal frame that hooked to the side of the bath and looked like a sunchair for a tiny old man.
"All this equipment. Only way to wash a baby this small is in the sink."
I knelt next to Estelle and helped unwrap the tiny package. Froggy limbs splayed, astonished.
"The shock,"
explained Estelle as the baby wailed. "She was warm and tight, and now she's cold and loose." I stood by as she lowered Sankofa, outraged and screaming, into a 7,000-pound hunk of Victorian porcelain I remember ordering.
"Dare, dare," said Estelle, wiping a cloth in the child's many wrinkled crevices.
After a minute or so, she cupped Sankofa's tiny backside in her hand, kissed her on her still screaming face, and told me to lay the swaddling blanket out in a triangle on the heated floor. I sat back on my heels and watched Estelle rub coconut butter all over the baby. To me, who had never so much as held a baby for more than a passing moment, the whole procedure looked masterful.
"Do you have children, Estelle?"
18, 16, and 15. But her hands were greasy, so she directed me to her back pocket, and I drew out her phone. I swiped right. Saw, for a moment, the uncluttered image of a tall young man in a high school graduate's robe, flanked on both sides by his smiling younger sisters. She told me their names and special talents, their heights and temperaments, and how often or not each one Skyped or replied to her on Facebook. Not often enough. In the 10 or so years we had both worked for Amy, this was the longest and most intimate conversation we'd ever had.
My mother take care of them for me. They go to the very best school in Kingston. Next thing he'll be heading to the University of the West Indies for engineering. He's a wonderful young man. The girls, they take him like a model. He's the star. They look up to him so much.
I'm Jamaican, I said, and Estelle nodded and smiled blandly at the baby. I had seen her do this many times, when gently humouring the children or Amy herself. Blushing, I corrected myself. I mean, my mother's people are from St. Catherine.
Oh, yes. I see. You ever been there?
No, not yet.
Well, you're still young.
She wrapped the child back up in its cocoon and held it to her breast.
Time's on your side.
Christmas came. The baby was presented to me, to all of us, as a fait accompli. A legal adoption, suggested and agreed upon by the parents, and nobody questioned this, or not out loud. No one asked what agreement could even mean in a situation of such deep imbalance. Amy was in the throes of baby love. Everyone else seemed happy for her. It was her Christmas miracle. All I had was suspicions, and the fact that the whole process had been hidden from me until it was already over. A few months later, I went back to the village for the final time, making inquiries as best I could. Nobody would speak to me about it or offer anything but happy platitudes. The birth parents were no longer living locally. No one seemed to know exactly where they had moved. If Fernando knew something about it, he wasn't going to tell me, and Hawa had moved to Serekunda with her Bakari. Lamin moped around the village. He was in mourning for her. Maybe I was, too. Evenings in the compound, without Hawa, were long, dark, lonely and conducted entirely in languages I didn't know. But though I told myself, as I headed out to Lamin's place, 5 or 6 times in all and always late in the night, that we too were acting on an uncontrollable physical desire, I think we both knew perfectly well that whatever passion existed between us was directed through the other person towards something else, towards Hawa, or towards the idea of being loved, or simply to prove to ourselves our own mutual independence from Amy. She was really the person we were aiming at with all our loveless fucking, as much a part of the process as if she were in the room. Creeping back from Lamin's to Howard's compound very early one morning, just before 5, as the sun came up, I heard the call to prayer, and I knew I was already too late to pass unwitnessed. A woman pulling a recalcitrant donkey, a group of children waving from a doorway, and so changed direction to make it look as if I were out for a walk for no particular reason, as everyone knew the Americans sometimes did. Circling back round the mosque, I saw Fernando right in front of me, leaning against the next tree, smoking. I'd never seen him smoke before. I tried smiling casually in greeting, but he fell in step with me and grabbed me painfully by the arm. He had beer on his breath. He looked like he hadn't slept at all.
What are you doing? Why do you do these things? Fern, are you following me?
He didn't answer until we were the other side of the mosque, by the huge termite hill, where we stopped, obscured from view on 3 sides. He let go of me and started speaking as if we had been in the middle of a long discussion.
And I have some good news for you. Thanks to me, he will be with you very soon on a permanent basis. Yes, thanks to me. I am going to the embassy today, in fact. I am working very hard behind the scenes to unite the young and not-so-young lovers, all 3 of them.
I began a denial, but there was no point. Fern was always very hard to lie to.
It must be a truly strong feeling you have for him to risk so much, so much. Last time you were here, you know, I suspected it and the time before, but somehow it is still a shock to have it confirmed.
But I don't have any feelings for him. All the fight went out of his face. You imagine this makes me feel better?
Finally, shame. A suspicious emotion. So ancient. We were always advising the girls in the academy not to feel it, because it was antiquated and unhelpful and led to practices of which we didn't approve. But I felt it at last. Please don't say anything. Please. I'm leaving tomorrow and that's it. It's just started and it's already over. Please, Fern. You have to help me.
I tried,
he said, and walked off in the direction of the school. The rest of the day was torture, and the next, and the flight was torture, the walk through the airport with my phone, a grenade in my back pocket. It didn't go off. When I walked into the London house, everything was as before, only happier. The children were well settled, at least we didn't hear from them. The last album was well received. Photographs of Lamin and Amy together, both looking beautiful, back at Jay's birthday from the concert, were in all the gossip rags and were more successful, in their way, than the album itself. And the baby had its debut. The world was not especially curious about logistics, as it turned out, and the papers considered her delightful. It seemed logical to everyone that Amy should be able to procure a baby as easily as she might order a limited edition handbag from Japan. Sitting in Amy's trailer one day during a video shoot, eating lunch with Mary Beth, personal assistant number 2, I tentatively introduced the topic, hoping to wheedle some information out of her. But I needn't have been so careful. Mary Beth was more than happy to tell me. I got the whole story. A contract had been drawn up by one of the entertainment lawyers a few days after Amy met the baby, and Mary Beth had been there to see it signed. She was delighted at this evidence of her own importance and what it suggested about my position in the hierarchy. She took out her phone and flipped through the pictures of Sankofa, her parents and Amy smiling together, and in among them I noticed was a screenshot of the contract itself. When she went to the bathroom and left her phone in front of me, I emailed the screenshot to myself. A 2-page document. A monumental amount of money in local terms. We spent about the same on household flowers in a year. When I brought this fact to Granger, my last ally, he surprised me by considering it a noble case of putting your money where your mouth is, and spoke so tenderly about the baby that everything I had to say sounded monstrous and unfeeling in comparison. I saw that rational conversation wasn't possible. The baby cast a spell. Granger was just as much in love with Kofi, as we called her, as everybody else who came near her. And God knows she was easy to love. Nobody was immune, certainly not me. Amy was besotted. She could spend an hour or two just sitting with the child on her knee, staring down at her without doing anything else, and knowing Amy's relationship with time, its value and scarcity to her, we all understood what a mighty measure of love this represented. The baby redeemed all kinds of deadening situations. Long meetings with the accountant, tedious dress fittings, PR strategy brainstorm sessions. She changed the colour of a day simply by means of her presence in the corner of whichever room, on the knee of Estelle or rocking in a Moses basket on a stand, chuckling, gurgling, crying, untarnished, fresh and new. The first chance we got, we'd all crowd around her, men and women of all ages and races, but all of us with a certain amount of time racked up in Amy's team, from worn old battle horses like Judy, to middle rankers like me, to young kids straight out of college. We all worshipped at the altar of the baby. The baby was starting from the beginning. The baby was uncompromised. The baby wasn't hustling. The baby needn't fake Amy's signature on 4,000 headshots heading for South Korea. The baby didn't have to generate meaning out of the broken shards of this and that. The baby was not nostalgic. The baby had no memories and no regrets. It did not need a chemical skin peel. It did not have a phone. It had no one to email. Truly, time was on its side. Whatever happened afterwards, it wasn't out of any lack of love for the baby. The baby was surrounded by love.
It's a question of what love gives you the right to do.
8.
In that last month of working for Amy, just before she fired me, in fact, we did a mini-European tour, starting with a show in Berlin, not a concert, a show of her photographs. These were photographs of photos, images appropriated and re-photographed. She had taken the idea from Richard Prince, an old friend from the old days, and added nothing to it except the fact that she, Amy, was doing it. Still, one of the most respected galleries in Berlin was more than happy to host her work. All the photos were of dancers. She thought of herself first and foremost as a dancer, and identified deeply with them. But I did all the research, and it was Judy who had taken most of the photos, as whenever the time came to go to the studio and re-photograph the photographs, there was always something else that had to be done. Meet and greets in Tokyo, the designing of a new perfume, sometimes even the recording of an actual song. We re-photographed Baryshnikov and Nureyev, Pavlova, Fred Astaire, Isadora Duncan, Gregory Hines, Martha Graham, Savion Glover, Michael Jackson. I argued for Jackson. Amy didn't want him. He wasn't her idea of an artist, but catching her in a harried moment, I managed to convince her, while Judy lobbied for a woman of color. She was worried about underrepresentation, she often was, which meant really that she was worried about what others might perceive as an underrepresentation, and whenever we had these conversations, I had the eerie sensation of viewing myself as really being one of these things, not a person at all, but a sort of object, without which a certain mathematical series of other objects is not complete, or not even an object, but a kind of conceptual veil, a moral fig leaf, protecting such and such a person from such and such a critique, and rarely thought of except when in this role. It didn't offend me, especially. I was interested in the experience. It was like being fictional. I thought of Jenny Lagon. I got my chance during a car ride over the border between Luxembourg, where Amy had gone to do a little press, and Germany. I took out my phone and Googled Lagon, and Amy looked over the images distractedly. She was texting simultaneously on her own phone. Well, I talked as quickly as I could of Lagon as person, actress, dancer, symbol, trying to keep a hold of her wavering attention, and suddenly she nodded decisively at a picture of Lagon and Bojangles together, of Lagon standing, dancing, in a pose of kinetic joy, and Bojangles kneeling at her feet, pointing at her, and she said, "Yes, that one. I like it, yes. I like the reversal, man on his knees, woman in control." Once I had that yes, I could at least start on the research for what would appear as text in the catalogue, and a few days later Judy took the photo, slightly at an angle, missing parts of the frame, for Amy had asked that they all be re-photographed this way, as if the photographer was dancing herself. As far as these things go, it was the most successful piece in the show, and I was glad of the chance to rediscover Lagon. Researching her, often alone, often late at night, in a series of European hotel rooms, I realized how much I had fantasized about her as a child, how fundamentally naive I had been about almost every aspect of her life. I'd imagined, for example, a whole narrative of friendship and respect between Lagon and the people she worked with, the dancers and the directors, or I'd wanted to believe that friendship and respect could have existed, in the same spirit of childish optimism that makes a little girl want to believe her parents are deeply in love. But Astaire never spoke to Lagon on set. In his mind, she not only played a maid, she was, in actuality, little different from the help, and it was the same with most of the directors. They didn't really see her and rarely hired her, not for anything except maid parts. And soon enough, even these roles dried up, and not until she got to France did she begin to feel like a person. When I learned all of this, I was in Paris myself, sitting in the sunshine in front of the Odeon Theatre, trying to read the information off the sun-blanched screen of my phone, drinking a Campari, checking the time compulsively. I watched the 12 hours Amy had allotted for Paris disappearing minute by minute, almost faster than I could experience them, and soon the cab would come, and then an airstrip would fall away beneath me, and onwards we would go, to another 12 hours in another beautiful, unknowable city, Madrid. I thought of all the singers and dancers and trumpet players and sculptors and scribblers who had claimed to feel like people, finally, here, in Paris, no longer shadows but people in their own right, an effect that possibly required more than 12 hours to take effect. And I wondered how these people were able to tell so precisely the moment that they began to feel like a person. The umbrella I sat under gave no shade. The ice had melted in my drink. My own shadow was huge and knife-like under the table. It seemed to stretch halfway across the square and to point at the stately White House on the corner, which took up most of the block, and outside of which a guide at that moment held up a little flag and began announcing a series of names, some known to me, some new. Thomas Paine, E.M. Turan, Camille Desmoulins, Sylvia Beach. A small circle of elderly American tourists stood around, nodding, sweating. I looked back at my phone. And so it was in Paris, I tapped this sentence out with my thumb, that Le Gon began to feel like a person. Which meant, I did not write this part down, that the person Tracy had imitated so perfectly all those years ago, the girl we'd watched dance with Eddie Cantor, kicking her legs, shaking her head, that was not really a person at all. That was only a shadow. Even her lovely name, which we'd both so envied, even that was unreal. In reality, she was the daughter of Hector and Harriet Ligon, migrated from Georgia, descendants of sharecroppers, while the other, Le Gon, the one we thought we knew, that happy-go-lucky hoofer, she was a fictional being, born of a typo, whom Luella Parsons dreamt up one day when she misspelt Ligon in her syndicated gossip column in the L.A. Examiner. 9. The grenade went off finally on Labor Day. We were in New York, a few days away from leaving for London, with a plan to meet Lamin there, his British visa finalized. It was foully hot. The rancid sewer air could prompt a smile between two strangers in the street as they passed each other. Can you believe we live here? It was like bile, and it was the scent of Mulberry Street that afternoon. I had my hand to my mouth as I walked, a prophetic gesture. By the time I reached the corner of Broome, I'd been fired. It was Judy who sent the text, and the dozen like it that followed, all of which were as stuffed with personal invective as they would have been had Amy written them herself. I was a whore and a traitor, a fucking this and a fucking that. Even Amy's personal outrage could be outsourced to a secondary party. A little light-headed, woozy, I got as far as Crosby and sat down on the front step of Housing Works, on the vintage clothes side. Every question sprouted more questions. Where will I live, and what will I do, and where are my books, and where are my clothes, and what is my visa status? I wasn't so much angry with Fern as annoyed at myself for not better predicting the timing. I should have been waiting for it. Didn't I know exactly how he was feeling? I could reconstruct his experience. Working on Lamin's visa paperwork, buying Lamin's air ticket, organizing Lamin's departure and arrival, his pickups and his drop-offs, enduring the emails back and forth between him and Judy at every stage of this planning, devoting all time and energy to somebody else's existence, to somebody else's desires and needs and requirements. It's a shadow life, and after a while it gets to you. Nannies, assistants, agents, secretaries, mothers, women are used to it. Men have a lower tolerance. Fern must have sent 100 emails about Lamin these past few weeks. How could he resist sending the one that would blow up my life? My phone buzzed so frequently it seemed to have an animal life of its own. I stopped looking at it and focused instead on a very tall brother in the window of Housing Works. He had tremendous, high-arched eyebrows and was holding up a series of dresses against his thick frame, stepping into a pair of roomy high heels. Spotting me, he smiled sucked in his stomach, did a little turn, and bowed. I don't know why or how, but the sight of him galvanized me. I stood up and hailed a taxi. Some questions were answered quickly.